People seem to forget, if you change today, today will change your life. To keep up with the latest episodes, make sure you subscribe to the Self-Belief Chief Podcast Facebook group, download your favourite ones, and this episode is brought to you by Odd Health, the easy way to speak to a nutritionist. Take control of your health and your body with the support of registered nutritionists online through the Odd Health app. You can even take a free questionnaire so that they can understand more about your goals to help with your first consultation. If you want to know more, on the selfbeliefchief.com/podcast page, underneath the episodes, you'll be able to find more information. Okay, so we have reached episode 100, and it's at this point that I want to say thank you for the people who've tuned in and listened, but I also want to do something a little bit different. And a while back, my dad, who frequently helps me compile questions for this podcast, much more interesting questions than I can come up with often, that provide some of the really helpful, useful conversations and just really, really good insight. And I thought it'd be good to have a conversation with him as someone who does do a lot of prep for these conversations, but also someone who is very much a hero of mine as well. And I wanted to be able to introduce him, someone who was looking forward to being on this podcast. I think as it came around sooner and sooner, his perspective on that might have changed. But it's very good to have him on. I'm very happy that he has come on. So firstly, to welcome you and for you to say hello to everyone.
Oh, hi there, David, or shall I call you son? David will do. And I don't know if you want to call me dad or Ron, but I don't mind. And also, I might be a hero of yours, but I've admired you for quite a long time as well, David.
So we've got all the awkward pleasantries out the way, but thank you very much. So firstly, I'll just talk about some of the things that I know that you have a deep interest in. And I think lots of people listening, you just find those things or stumble across those things which you have a real passion for, which you don't really, you know, cultivate or ask to be passionate about those things. They just kind of find you. And one of the things that I've have an interest in, but you've got a thousand times greater knowledge and interest in, is space. And I wanted to talk to you a bit about space in terms of what is the kind of core fascination around that, and very much if it aligns to why I find it interesting. But I know you love the idea of space and exploration. I know you've also spoken about the chance to leave us as a family when the time comes to be able to fly into space as well. In all seriousness, where did your fascination and interest in space start?
I guess I've always had a fascination with science generally, and but what happened in 1960s as I was growing up was the Apollo moon landings. And they were headline news everywhere in the world. And you couldn't escape all the detail in the newspapers. So if you're at all interested in science or engineering, then you had acres and acres of in those days, newsprint or TV to just wallow in. And I just found it fascinating. So that would be one entry point. The other entry point, my parents bought me one of those sort of big picture books on astronomy. I don't know how old I was. I think I must have been about five at the time. And I just loved leafing through that and seeing all these things which seemed quite exotic to me. And they were only hand-drawn images in those days because there weren't very good pictures of planets and other stuff in those days. So these were hand-drawn images of the planets, of the sun, of the solar system, of the universe and the galaxies in between. So I found that fascinating too. And then as I grew older, the idea that actually space exploration was quite a fascinating idea, and I got into science fiction, so I enjoyed that immensely. And then as I got a bit older still and started to realize quite what the moon landings had achieved from the point of view of what the astronauts must have been like as people, or the engineering that went into it, I just loved all that. So I know I've bored a lot of my friends and family silly talking about it, so I'll just stop at that point in case I'm doing the same to your listeners.
No, I think it's just nice when most people find it interesting when you get to listen to someone who is passionate about something. And I know you've sort of flown planes, and I know as maybe at some point in your life you felt as if, oh, I wonder if I could travel into space. So when you think about the thought about the actual idea or the possibility of actually being able to do that, what is it exactly amongst all the reasons why you're interested? What exactly is it about that that you would love to experience? Why would the experience be so amazing for you?
Yeah, well, whilst I think about how to answer that question, I'll tell a story that you remember me telling about just after your mum, Sarah, and I were married, and we were sitting in bed one Sunday morning and reading the newspapers, and there's a full page advert in the paper saying, do you want to go into space? And I looking at this thinking, well, yeah, I do, because I've always wanted, like, the idea of that. And this advert said, do you have a science degree? Well, I did. And it said, do you speak a foreign language? Well, I did. And I said, do you have a pilot's license? And at that time I did. So I thought, well, I'm halfway into space already. How much, you know, who else is going to be so qualified as me? And I didn't share this excitement with Sarah at the time. I just sat on it for 3 days, seriously contemplating applying for this. And I've told that story many times over the years, and I decided not to apply for it. And the reasons I gave when I tell the story is because when we got married, that wasn't what Sarah had signed up for, that her husband, who might disappear off to Russia for 2 years training and then might go into space. As the years have gone on, I realized that some of the deeper reasons were probably my own cowardice and my recognition of my own the likelihood that I might not quite be the successful candidate amongst the thousands that applied. But the reason I thought about it seriously for 3 days, coming back to your question, I really cannot think of anything more exciting as a view than looking back on the Earth and appreciating your place in the universe. And there's two things going on looking back on Earth. There's how small we are, but also how much man has imprinted himself on Earth. Not necessarily in bad ways. That's not an environmental point I'm making. It's just when you see all those cities beneath you, or the small towns and villages lit up, and you see ships on the oceans, it just must be mesmerizing. And when you hear astronauts talking about looking at the Earth, they cannot tear themselves away from the window. So there's that aspect of it. I just cannot think of a better view. Yes, we have beautiful views on Earth, and I've been fortunate to see a few of them. But I just can't think of anything more compelling. And then when you face the other way and look into the blackness of space and the pinpricks of light, because when we see them through the Earth's atmosphere from the ground, made a bit blurry by the atmosphere. But when you're out in space, they're pinpricks in an otherwise complete blackness. And then seeing the sun rise over the rim of the Earth, it just filled with wonderment. And the fact that somehow, if I were there, I'd be living some of this boyhood fascination with science fiction stories. I guess that's what would compel me to want to go into space. Apart from being a coward, though.
You mentioned about the darkness or the blackness and seeing the pinpricks amongst all of that. And how easy is that for you in moments coming away from space where the world does seem darker or the picture's not very clear for you to still see those, as you described, pinpricks, but I guess those points of beauty or points of, you know, kind of amazement or whatever. You and I think in that regard can be quite different, and you might well have a better ability at seeing those at points than I do. How easy do you find it to see those moments when through darker times that we have in life to see those sort of, I guess, pinpricks.
So the question is sort of moved from the actuality of looking at space into sort of a metaphorical analogy. I guess a couple of things come to mind. I'm a half cup full sort of person. There are some friends of mine, very old friends of mine who know me very well, who think I'm a bit of a naive optimist at times, but I don't mind if that's the truth of it. I quite like the living in my fantasy of a naively optimistic world. I am a half cup full sort of person. I tend to see the possibilities. So that in things rather than the negativities. I don't think I've ever had to face a desperate adversity. So how would I react to that? I don't know. And I wouldn't wish to be dishonest enough to claim that I do, but there's been a few sort of bumps along the way. So when those bumps arrive, I think I see them as problems that have to be addressed rather than, my first response after is, well, how are we going to fix this, I guess. And the third thing I can think of is I compartmentalize quite easily most of the time. So if something comes up, it sits in its own space in my mind and doesn't osmotically infect other areas in my mind. And again, I don't want to make a pretense about that. You know, when something bad happens, it does hang over you, but it's still compartmentalized and to a large extent in terms of sort of functioning and trying to fix the problem as I see it. So I guess that's how I keep the, and if you want to see those compartments as the for me, they're pinpricks as well, actually. So it's not just the good things in life, but the adversities are also opportunities to fix things and maybe fix them even better than they were before.
Yeah, I get that. I can understand that. And to touch back onto space, I only wanted to bring that up because it seemed an apt analogy.
Thanks for that curveball there. Yeah.
So with some of the work being done and the sort of innovation in and around space and exploration, how important do you see all of that? Because we go back to the 60s and 70s where sort of talking from a kind of US communist rivalry or US Russia rivalry, and they need to get to the moon, and lots of different meanings and reasons or needs to visit space for the first time. Moving to the present day, how important do you see space exploration, and how critical, if it is, do you think it is? Do you think we should be investing more or less?
You're sort of asking the wrong person there, because I start off as a point of principle. We've all got our principles that sort of guide our thoughts about stuff generally. So I respect those that say we've got enough problems on Earth that we need to spend money on. Let's spend the money that we are, in their words, wasting on space, on the problems we have on Earth. And I respect that as a point of view, but I don't, as a point of principle, come from there. I come from the point of view that this is a very big, wide world. There are a ton of opportunities and a ton of problems. And there are currently 7.5 billion people on the planet who might be able to solve some of the problems or take some of the opportunities we've got. If we don't give them free rein through research, through exploration, to do whatever it is that floats their boat, then we are constraining humanity in some way. And I guess examples don't spring to the top of mind very quickly, but there are so many examples of some basic research in basic sciences, physics, chemistry, biology, and even mathematics, where the scientists who were doing it, and whenever, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, did not know what application that science would be put to. But lo and behold, decades or centuries later, something that benefits humanity in ways that were inconceivable but vast take place. So it seems to me completely wrong to tell Jeff Bezos that he can't spend his billions exploring space and in his words, finding a way to escape planet Earth for when mankind needs a second home. It would be wrong to do that, and it'd be wrong to curtail anything. So that's how I approach your question.
Okay, so so very on the fence. No, I can understand. Yeah. I was trying to rope you into some sort of juicy tabloid headline here.
Yeah, the tabloids would be very interested in what I've got to say. I realise that. But.
So to move on to one of your other interests, something that I will maybe not beat you again at ever, is chess, which I know is everyone's most exciting game. but you're obviously good at it, and I think lots of people, you know, they have.
We'll think I'm a nerd by now. Yeah. With space and chess. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've got to be honest. So we'll talk about your surfing and everything else that you do.
Yeah, the cool stuff. Yeah. Okay.
So you like to collect chess sets. I haven't noticed you actually. I can't think of the last time you got a new chess set. Have you got a new chess set recently?
No, not for quite a while now. I think ran
you
out of space.
One about once a year, a new chess set, aren't we?
Well, I think at one point it got to maybe two or three a year. But the thing about chess sets, well, the thing about chess is, apart from being perceived as a nerdy game for certain types of people, and I do get that. But I can assure your thousands of listeners that not all chess players are like that. And for me, it's a terrific game because it pits two people in open combat, mental combat, and it is a war. And when you're playing it, you want to kill the other person. You absolutely want to defeat them. It becomes very competitive and very a very visceral feeling if you play competitive chess, that you really want to beat the other person. But it's an odd game because you can see everything that's on the board. The only thing you can't see is what the other person might be thinking. But when they deploy their troops, and that's how you've got to think about these chess pieces as troops being deployed by a general, you can see, more so than in general in real life, exactly what the troop deployment is. So it's a really interesting battle of wits, which I'm not actually very good at, because I make careless mistakes.
Am I just really terrible?
No, you're, of course not. And but there, I'm not good enough to lay claim to being a good chess player. So chess sets for me. So if chess is emblematic of a battle of wills between two armies, then when you look around the world at how chess sets have been fashioned by different cultures and different societies at different times, most of them, of course, are depicting the battles of the times. So you've got the Greeks versus the Romans, or the Spanish versus the Arabs, or whatever. So to see all of these characters from history or from different parts of the planet represented, it is for me just sort of quite fun. And I've never collected particularly valuable sets. They come in all different shapes, sizes, materials. One of my proudest or most pleasing chess sets is one for a doll's house. It cost me £6 however many decades ago, and it's about 4 centimeters square board. The pieces are tiny, but I just love it. So yeah, that is because it just represents many cultures, many different times in history, and this battle of wills between a fight to the death.
The reason I brought up the chess was the reason I brought up the chess was
the pinpricks of life in a chess match.
I always find it quite amazing, considering how long those games go on, in terms of focus and concentration. There are players that, you know, they're not necessarily the case with yourself, but they play, you know, a game can last hours and hours and hours. For you, in terms of that mental concentration and that level of focus and not switching off, which I think most people have, it's tough to be in a place where if it does last a considerable amount of time when you've got that kind of mental stress, is how do you keep up that mental concentration? How do you not kind of switch off or take a back step? Because when you play, you can't really do that, can you? Because you forget what's going on, or you step out of the place and the other person's still in that place. And I think for a lot of people that makes a lot of sense, even if they don't necessarily do it or understand it through chess. But how do you keep yourself I know you often say, oh, I made this stupid mistake, or oh, I would have won all of these games if I just hadn't done this. So obviously,
yeah, you're being a bit generous there, because what you usually say to me, not in public, is that when I come back complaining about having made a stupid mistake, you say that every single time. So
yeah, that's true. Maybe okay, next question instead. You're right. Your focus is terrible.
Well, it is. So I sit there and my mind wanders a bit too easily. The competitive matches I play, and they take about 3 hours. World championship matches, I think they're about 6 hours long. I might be wrong about that. It does take a lot of concentration. But the moments I love in chess is when you're so lost in the match that your mind doesn't drift. And I'm not at the level where this is true, but I guess when I'm in those moments, I can sort of glimpse what I read the world champions say, that it's as if they're moving in a different plane and seeing patterns on the chessboard in front of their eyes. They don't really think in terms of if I do this, then this happens, and if I do this, then this happens. They see patterns evolving and almost like clouds moving in and out of focus. And so when you're really lost in a game, I'm nowhere near what that description I just gave, but you're so absorbed in it that's quite good fun. But my mind otherwise does wander too easily, so I'm not sure how I can better answer your question. But let me ask you a question, because there are some games where you've beaten me despite your proclaimed
Well, I can remember when I was 5, and then I didn't realize until I was a teenager that obviously I hadn't won because you'd let me win, unless you're about to tell me otherwise and it's really embarrassing for you. But I can't think of the other times.
On several occasions, you've brought this up and I've posed the question, unless you let me win. And I've enigmatically left that floating in the air. But on the couple of occasions where it's happened, I think there was one when you were 5, and there's another time a bit older. We haven't played chess that often. And the couple of times where you beat me, I didn't let you in. So go,
so
David.
I just realised this is a podcast and I'm celebrating in the background and no one can actually know what's going on. It's just silence. Oh, finally. Truth is out. So why did you not tell me?
Pride.
Right.
Pride.
Yeah.
It's pure and simple.
Well, this podcast has been worth it now. What are you most looking forward to outside of chess, everything else at this point in your life? What are you looking forward to the most?
Well,
Dramatic pauses aren't quite as effective on podcasts.
Yeah, they aren't, are they? And the cold sweat that I've come out in isn't visible on a podcast either. I think I'd have to say the fairly saccharine, I'd give the fairly saccharine answer to see you and Catherine, your sister, just continually moving forward in your lives and making successes, hopefully, and having...
Because we're not successes yet.
Having more successes. And I said moving forward, and that's how, as in having more successes. And so as saccharine as that might seem, that's the most important thing that I would look forward to. Mm-hmm. Sorry, not a more interesting answer in many ways.
I sort of would have judged you if it was a different answer, to be honest, I guess, having now that you've said that.
That's why I paused for so long, because that was the first answer to came to my mind.
And I mean, you paused and then you only came up with that. I mean, that's...
Well, because that was the only answer. So I was pausing to think, is there a different answer? But also, do I dare give this answer? Because is there a better answer to give than that saccharine one? That's why there was a long pause. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
You can edit it out.
It's fine. Oh, you want us to do well, grr. presuming that the answer might be along those lines, what is it? What is it like parenting my sister and I?
Oh, it's a joy.
Yeah. Okay. What are the differences in terms of parenting styles that you have to provide or utilize with each of us?
Can I tell your listeners that the reason you're asking this question is because you're determined to discover which one of the you two is favourite?
No, we know they don't. Well, we know which one's the favourite, and I've made peace with that. So I've dealt with that fine now. It's made me who I am. So we've gone through those hardships. Are there different parenting styles? Are there different ways that you, with Catherine and I, that you thought actually we got to approach them differently because they are different? It might not be even a conscious thing, but.
Well, I can't. I'm not. So I answer on, obviously, for myself, I'm as opposed to parenting in general. And I guess the answer is yes and no. I'll start with the no. The attitude that both Sarah and I take, I think we both agree, is to encourage, even from a young age, a very young age, to be self-sufficient, to support when needed, and to and to ensure that boundaries are understood and applied. And by boundaries, I don't just mean sort of in the normal discipline sense. And of course, I do mean that. But not that I think either as a rigid disciplinarians, but their boundaries are important for kids, but also boundaries, not just of a personal nature, but a societal nature. So we have responsibilities to society and to other people. And for me, that sort of fits under the heading of boundaries. So the commonality is encouragement, support, and boundaries, underpinned, of course, with huge ladles of love. But where the yes comes in, so that's the no bit, no differences. Where the yes comes in is you sort of soon discover that your children are different. And when they behave differently, they need to be treated differently. So, but that different treatment is within the context that I've just described of encouragement, support, and boundaries. And you just have to measure things a little bit differently. So apply things a bit differently in different cases. So, yeah, Catherine tended to be more compliant with instruction, and on occasions, you were a bit less compliant with at the first point of asking, and so at times there were differences in We had to encourage you to see our point of view on things.
But as you now know, it turned out I was right in those occasions.
Of course you were. But if I can, well, have you done with that question? Because if I can move it on, because part of the joy of parenting is what you learn. It's not what you teach. And so I've learnt from watching you both. I've learnt from some of the things you do. So in your case, how the stuff you're doing with self-belief, Chief, and the courage and the challenges that takes. And I'm not just saying this. I've learnt from watching that, because on the few occasions I've thought of doing something entrepreneurial, one of the reasons I've decided against it is because I don't have that spirit in me. So you learn stuff from your children. You learn that everyone's different. And as a parent, at some point you discover, and this takes a few years, you discover that everyone's different. And the idea that, not that I ever thought this consciously at all, I emphasize that, but I realized that subconsciously I was assuming that you and maybe she, but you maybe as a male, should be a bit like me. And eventually it dawned on me, with a bit of a nudge from Sarah on one occasion that I remember, saying that they don't have to be like you. And that absolutely true. And at that point, you have to sort of realize that there's a point to step in as a parent. For instance, when the child's about to cross the road or run into the road, you sort of step in. But a lot of times we'd have to step back, even when they're very young, let them fall over and hurt themselves is the only way they discover that not to try and run where they shouldn't run. So the stepping in and stepping back bit, and the older the children get, the more you have to step back. And that's a journey of discovery as well. And then learning that as you and Catherine got older, that you've got our back as much as we have yours. That's been a great joy as well. So yeah, I think we end up learning more from you than you ever learn, or at least as much from you guys as you learn from us. So have I neatly sidestepped the how you different?
I thought it was a really good answer. I hadn't thought of it in those terms before, or necessarily would have assumed that you thought of it in those terms. So when you talk about lessons learned, what did you learn from Catherine? Well, this is hard. Oh. This is taking longer. That's a quick answer for me.
What did I learn? Hang on. What did I say I learned from you?
Well, about, you learn in terms of the entrepreneurial side of...
I see. Okay. All right. From Catherine. Oh, that's a good question. Let me think about that one.
It's really scratching our heads here.
I hadn't prepared for that one. From Catherine. I think both of you have got a measure of me and a measure of mum, and hopefully, because none of us are perfect, hopefully the measures of the good bits of us are greater than the measures of the bad bits of us. And Catherine has maintained very good contact with friends from whatever era, and the way she does that, I can only marvel at, because I'm not built like that. Sarah's built more like that, but I don't know if Sarah would agree. I think she would. Catherine sort of beats us both at that. She does it very well. She does it in a very genuine way, and I actually it's not something I've learned from her, because I wish I could learn it from her. I'm just not built that way. But
yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that's definitely the great quality that she has. And so there's the. We had to give her something, didn't we? there's the lessons that you suggest that you, or you know, not lessons necessarily, but you observe people, you know, a different way of living to a certain extent and new ways of going about things. But aside from us, in terms of lessons that you've learned, over the course of your life, and actually what were relevant and what were impactful and what you noticed really made a difference for you at whatever stage. Can you think of particular lessons that you feel that maybe you're not learned in a particular moment, but say you talked about the joy of being able to learn from us. What are the things you've learned from other people?
Oh, blimey. That's a very long list. I don't know where to start. I can absolutely identify with things that my parents taught me. For my mother, she's a brilliant cook, so I've inherited a love, if not an ability of cooking that she has, but also her active love of family, not just the immediate family. She gets so many visits and calls from so many nieces and nephews, and that's because she's reaping as she sowed in life. She gave love and hospitality so frequently to so many. And again, a bit like we were talking about Catherine a moment ago, I have a bit of that gene, but nowhere near as much as my mum does. For my dad, I just learnt so much about, he was a role model for me in terms of how to be a man. I don't mean that as a man's man. I just mean that as a male, as a father. And the practical bent he has to fix anything. We did take a TV apart once and never put it back together again, but the learning of the curiosity to you can try to fix anything, and then the ability to fix some things comes from him. But then in the world of work, where I've had so many mentors, normally not explicit mentors, but people that I just looked to and thought, I'm learning from you. So there's a long list of those. I not just as a name check, but I would throw in my sisters. From whom the importance of family is also reinforced, and they both have their talents that I observe and learn from. Probably add two more to this. My longest and oldest friend. I've got two very old friends, and they're both very, very good friends. But one in particular, who is much longer in the our relationship than the other one. He and I spent ages just sort of working out the meaning of life as we were teenagers, and that put me in great stead. Whether we actually worked out the meaning of life and solved things is obviously in great doubt, but that was very formative. And then finally, your mum, with whom we had just passed 37 years of marriage yesterday, and I learned from her most days. Too much to mention. But you asked, what did I learn? I'll try and think of something specific that I learned from Sarah amongst the many, many things. A very practical and strong-minded compassion. If something needs saying or doing, she'll say it or do it, and do it in a very practical, considered and compassionate way. And I respect that a lot.
And there's always the balance between, you know, you want to learn and digest information and observe from everyone. And I think lots of people who listen to this podcast are also in a place where they're constantly wanting to learn, but they also want to know, well, actually, when do I learn and observe from other people and try and maybe try and attempt things in a different way, and when do I trust my instinct? So I wanted to ask you, for you, all the things that you pick up from other people and things that you mentioned which you could wish you do better. And you sort of had a background in a number of different industries, as well as a sort of consultant industry, in which, you know, you're sharing valuable information back and forth. There comes a point where you've kind of got to back yourself or trust your instinct or know when to close off the noise from everyone else so you can do what feels more instinctively right to you. I'll ask a slightly easier version of what I was going to ask, which is, in terms of your instinct, does that ever feel questionable to you? Does that feel something that you feel like you've always been able to reliably trust that instinct, or have there been occasions where you find that to be more challenging?
You'll know I can get into the detail and think through a problem for a very long time, and that's not an instinctual that's not indicative of an instinctive behavior, but other times, many other times, and of course, even when you go into detail, you have instincts about things which you bring into play, and I do by and large trust my instinct, but I like to think I trust it in a measured sort of way. It's a questioning sort of way. I like to think that some of the time, at least, I can spot if something's an instinct rather than an observable fact, and then ask myself questions about the instinct. But of course, there are times when you've got to act on instinct because you have to act more quickly, and I do tend to trust that. I can certainly think of occasions where I've regretted the instinctive reaction, but more often than not, that's not been the case. But there have been a few times when the regret has replaced the instinct. You can regret things said or done, and you can't undo that. And sometimes I do. If I wake up in the night and think about stuff, on some occasions, I'll run through a few of the things I wish I hadn't done, and I'll run through a few of the people I wish I could apologise to. Even if I'd apologised to them at the time, I'd still say yeah, there are some regrets. But no, most of the time I do trust my instinct, and it served me fairly well. But I go back to what I started off by saying. I do tend to go into the detail about stuff. So I like to think that my instincts are grounded in rationalism, even if the rationalism is subconscious.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the most important reason why I ask about instinct is because you and Mum are highly competitive. And so being able to trust your instinct in those key battles and those key moments when you play your Bananagram or whatever other game, cool games you guys are playing these days. Is you're going to be able to trust that instinct and be super focused. And it's the real battles of the week. It's going to set up the whole week. And for one person, it's going to be a great week. And for the other person, it's more disappointment. Who is more competitive between the two of you?
I just want to take a bit of an aside here, because I'm enjoying this conversation. I don't know if you are, and I certainly don't know if the people who would... going to listen to it, if they get to this point, because it's obviously quite sort of personal in a sense. But it does lead me to wonder whether you're actually not going to use this as a podcast. This is just a way of trying to ask me some questions that I might not otherwise want to answer under the pretext that it's for the benefit of your podcast audience.
Yes.
I thought so. Who's the more competitive? Well, I would say she is, and she would say I am.
Who wins more often?
That depends on what we're playing. Okay.
Who's a better winner?
Probably more. I don't think either of us are bad losers, just to get that in very quickly, but probably more often than not, she's the marginally better winner. But I don't know, actually. I don't know. I think about the same. I don't know. I do a bit more sledging than she does, so I'm factoring that into my answer.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one relationship where you should be able to trash talk, isn't it?
Yeah. So,
who's the better loser?
No, again, I think I'd say a draw on that one too.
Oh God,
we're competitive, but we're fairly gracious most of the time. But I do sledge more than she does.
What's your favourite game that you both play?
Currently we're in a Bananagram period, as you know. Previously, there've been other things, but Bananagram at the moment. As exciting as that sounds,
yeah,
great game.
No, it's not.
Is this podcast sponsored by Bananagram?
Sponsored by Bananagram.
Isn't it?
it's a boring, terrible game, it's fairly mind numbing. Maybe it's just because I'm no good at it as well. So next quick fire question, which isn't coming to me quickly enough, but
that's the quick fire questions. Quick fire answers need quick fire questions.
So. Yes, they do. I mean, do you have a quick fire question for me?
Who's your favorite parent?
Draw.
Who's your favourite sister?
Draw. My one sister's a draw. Yeah. Beautiful.
Is this conversation going along the lines of you hoped it would do?
It's doing just fine.
Totally good. Totally good.
What's the best thing about Mum?
Oh, too many things to list.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry for people listening.
I think I appreciate, I've already mentioned one thing, which I appreciate. I'll mention one other thing I appreciate, which is that she is a very good and loyal friend. I'll mention one other thing, which is that she is... One thing that first attracted me to Sarah is her ability, how lovely she looked in whatever situation she was in. And I don't mean that just from a physical point of view. So whether it was putting silly faces on the beach or dressing up to go somewhere, or where she just looked lovely in every situation and was just lovely company in every situation.
Okay. So you also have been writing various books over the years.
Finally, bloody hell. We're trying to get to this promotional part of the podcast.
So, which is your favourite book that you have been working on? Very different. We've all had multiple reads of them, so we all have our opinions.
We
all say draw as well.
If I can make this public apology to my family, they have had to read a few too many manuscripts a few too many times. No. I'm sure, so much appreciated.
Thank you. And I'll say thank you on behalf of...
one of the reasons I got them to read one of the manuscripts so much was none of them were actually interested in the topic I was writing about.
Oh.
And I knew that they would ask me lots of questions that I had not managed to... express the answer clearly in the text. So there's the first thing I wrote was a story for Catherine, but it became a story for Catherine and you, David. But mainly it was Catherine's story about George the Giant, and in those politically incorrect days, Mickey Midget, since renamed George the Giant and Minnie Mickey. So the story about two people. Two children, one too small, one too large, outcast by their friends, who discover each other and become friends for life. And that was a bedtime story made up by yours truly, and then for Catherine's 30th birthday turned into a book that is on Amazon if you wish to buy that for your children, nieces, nephews, friends, kids, etc., at a very modest price. And I'm kidding with the promotional bit here. That's me just trying to play act, someone on Graham Norton's show. The second thing, apart from some small bits of writing, I then had this idea for some small bits of writing, which generally were like, I'd have an idea of something, but I knew I couldn't write. So I would just write it down in a few pages or a few words, and then just for my own benefit. I enjoyed that process, but knew I couldn't otherwise write. And then I had this idea for a sort of speculative fiction, a book. One of my sisters said, well, that would make a great book. I said, oh, I don't do books, so I can't write dialogue and I don't do plot. Anyway, that became a book, which is not yet out. And then I've had a lifelong, returning to space a bit, I've had a lifelong interest in the topic of relativity. And I had probably failed to understand it in any...
That's all we have time for, thank you.
...in any meaningful way. I'd failed countless times to understand it. And then eventually, I used to find any one book completely unsatisfactory at answering the questions that you try to grapple with when you read about relativity. But the internet is a marvelous thing, and you can read a bit here and a bit there. And finally, there are enough different jigsaw pieces from different sources that I managed to piece something together. And that became a book called Relativity Explained. The purpose of which, so I didn't start off with the intention of writing a book, but I did start off with the intention of writing down the notes of this understanding I'd finally achieved, so that I would be able to go back and remember what I'd previously understood. And at one point I looked at these notes and thought, well, maybe this would be good for other people as well. So that one is available on Amazon, Relativity Explained by Ron Hulman. Thank you for the plug. End of podcast.
No, it takes a lot of work and effort to write something, and as many different things as you've looked at as well. And you know that the relativity one, I know what it's like to have your work teased apart or scrutinized and all of that. Mm. And the fact that I've done that on one occasion, you've done that on multiple occasions is an enjoyable / difficult experience at the same time. But
I think what you did with your book is Thinking Lies, also available in all good bookstores, is a far braver thing to do than I did. And
mine's much better. Yeah, buy mine before. Yeah. Buy all of them together.
It is a good read. Yeah.
Yeah. Want to finish up with what is going to be one of those questions that will probably make you think a little bit. You mentioned
it will. Yes, I know the question's coming.
Yeah. No, you mentioned earlier that sort of in teenage years, we're talking about you and your friend, and sort of the meaning of life, and not really knowing what that necessarily looks like, as none of us really do ever work out. But having spent some time, it sounds like, trying to work out what that is, and maybe also, you know, working, getting to know me and my insightful ways, and obviously I've brought so much to your life. What do you think the meaning is, at least for you?
Sorry, pauses don't work very well on podcasts, so I better speak whilst I'm thinking. I have a very simplistic attitude, which I know you and I have talked about before, David. So whether this is quite the answer you're looking for, I don't know, but we can start with this. And I guess I've learned more recently through reading a bit of philosophy that there's maybe a little bit of existentialism creeping in. Sort of that mid-1900s philosophy. But I discovered at some point that I was a bit more ambitious than I realized I was. But then I also realized that I wasn't quite as ambitious as all that. So there are some people who want to be CEO, but I never wanted to do that. So I found myself grappling with this question I am ambitious on the one hand, but I'm not very ambitious. So what does that add up to? So I did need to have a little bit of a think about things at that point. And I came up with this fairly, very, very simple sounding philosophy. So is it a meaning of life? I don't know. I don't know that I would be quite so grandiose as to suggest that it is, but it sort of has carried me through, which is that you spend a third of your life, roughly speaking, in your personal life. You spend about a third of your life at work, and you spend a third of your life sleeping. Not necessarily equal thirds, just three parts. And if you're not happy in all of those, and happiness means obviously sleeping well, a healthy personal life, not just in body but in mind, and a career that fulfills you in whatever way it needs to, because for each of us that's different, then if you can say yes to three of those things some of the time, if you can say yes to at least two of them much of the time, then you're probably somewhere in a fairly useful place. Now, you can factor into it that whatever it is that fulfills you. So if you are somebody who has a broad outward looking view, you can do all the charitable stuff you want to do within that personal life bit, or indeed within the world work life part of it. So that sort of simple model is not meant to be a selfish model. It's meant to be a model that whatever sort of floats your own boat. If sleeping well means 6 hours sleep or 10 hours sleep, that's what works for you. So that's been my simple version of it. And I guess I should underline it with and try and do some good in the world whilst you're at it.
Yeah, I've always liked that philosophy that you have. No, I've tried to adopt that more and more so. Is there any more that you feel the need to say?
Did we talk about my book yet?
Yeah, we get that bit short.
Okay. I'd like to say that I have enjoyed your podcasts.
Yeah, but that's because you come up with a lot of the questions.
No, that's not true. And I think that you I won't say more on that line. So I take it as a sort of an honor, which I appreciate, to be part of your 100th podcast.
I assumed that would be the case. The fact that you felt the need to say that is almost, you know, just safely presume that all guests, and yes, for you to be the 100th, I guess, has some sort of special meaning. But
when this goes viral, will I get some sort of share of profit or?
Yes, and I will let you know at some point what that is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for joining me.
It's been a real pleasure, more so than I had expected and not as much as I had feared. Thank you very much.